The Oracle Network.
Riddle Me That is a true crime podcast that deals with adult themes. Some episodes explore disturbing topics such as murder, abuse, sexual violence, drug abuse, suicide, and self-harm. Please listen at your own risk. Theories discussed in episodes may not be the opinion of the host.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Jules, and this is Riddle Me That, True Crime. Today, I'm really excited to welcome Mark McClish to the show. Mark is an expert in statement analysis. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks, Jules. Thank you for having me on your show.
You're so welcome. So, Mark, do you want to tell my listeners a little bit about you and your background?
Yeah, I'm a retired supervisory deputy United States Marshal. I spent 24 years with the Marshal Service, 9 of those years teaching interviewing techniques at our training academy. And during that time, I did studies on deceptive language and developed the statement analysis techniques to detect deception in a verbal and written statement. And what you'll find is that statement analysis is the most accurate way of determining if a person's lying or telling the truth. And that's because people's words will betray them. People may want to lie and withhold information, but they will give us more information than what they realize. Unfortunately, they sometimes give us more information than what we realize. It all gets down to listening. And that's what I teach people, mainly law enforcement officers, what to listen for in a person's statement to determine if that person's being truthful or deceptive.
So I invited Mark on the show to talk with me a little bit about one of the most polarizing aspects of the Darlie Routier case, the 911 call, as well as bits of her testimony and statement. I'll link these in the show notes. Due to time concerns, we cannot go through all three line by line, so we're going to touch on the pertinent details, and you can feel free to go ahead and read these in their entirety. Mark, can I ask you what your overall first impressions were when listening to the call or reading the transcripts?
Overall, I saw several areas of deception in her statements or 911 calls. And so it was enough for me to be concerned about was she being truthful or deceptive.
So how long does it take someone to be trained in statement analysis in an unofficial capacity versus trained for use in law enforcement?
Well, in an unofficial capacity, you know, within a week, if somebody took some training and practiced, you know, analyzing statements, they could become pretty proficient at it, especially if they're watching true crime TV shows. You know, within the first 15, 20 minutes, by listening to what people are saying, they could probably figure out who did it. Now, to become an expert at it, to use in law enforcement, that takes, you know, at least a good year, again, of training in the techniques, but also practicing the techniques. That's where it really comes into handy, because it's difficult to spot every single indication of deception, but the more you practice it, then the better you get at it.
So I'm going to have Mark tell you all about his books at the end of the episode so you too can learn the art and science of statement analysis. So first, when you're approaching something like a 911 call, a trial transcript, or statement to law enforcement for analysis, what approach do you take?
Well, I tell people to, when you're looking at a statement, believe what people tell you. Now, that sounds a little strange because some people are thinking, well, if somebody's lying to me, I should believe the lies. Well, no, because what you'll find is that most of the time people are not lying. We think they're lying, but if you listen closely, you'll realize, well, they've qualified their statement. So technically they haven't told a lie. So by taking that approach, I'm going to believe what this person's telling me. A lot more things come to light because you'll recognize, as I mentioned, they qualified their statement or they did not answer the specific question. And also by taking that approach, I'm going to believe what you're telling me. We don't interpret because a lot of times people have the intention to want to interpret what somebody says, but we should never interpret. And that's because people mean exactly what they say.
Do you want to give the listeners an example of an outright lie versus a qualifying statement?
Well, the easiest way to lie is to keep it very your statement or your answer very short. So to say, no, I didn't do it, when a person in fact did do it, that would be a lie. And that would be a good lie. But what happens is the person has a hard time saying it. They have a hard time denying the act itself. So instead of saying, I didn't do it, they might say something like, well, I would never do that. Well, you can't use the word never as a substitute for the word no. To say, no, I didn't do it, that's a good denial. But to say, I never did it, is a very poor denial. And that's what you'll find a lot when people give denials. They won't deny the act itself, but they'll just say, I couldn't have done that, I wouldn't have done that, something like that. They may even say, I deny doing it, but still, that stops short of saying, I didn't do it. That's what we're looking for in a good denial.
And I think everybody can relate probably at some point in their life where either they've been the one saying it or their partner has, but you've said, hey, you've cheated on me. And they say, I would never do that. I think that's one that everyone can relate to.
That's a good example.
Yeah. So how does analyzing a 911 call differ from analyzing other statements?
Well, in a 911 call, the first thing we're looking at is the plea for help. You know, what is the caller asking for? Now, an innocent caller who maybe witnessed something or came across somebody that's unconscious will ask for help for the victim. For example, a husband might call 911 and say, my wife's passed out. I can't revive her. Send an ambulance. So they tell us what's going on and they ask for help. Send an ambulance. But a guilty caller, perhaps the caller is the perpetrator, a lot of times won't ask for help. They'll say, in that same example with an unconscious spouse, they may say, you know, I need an ambulance, but they haven't told the operator why they need an ambulance, or their wife or spouse is in trouble. And again, notice what they're saying. I need an ambulance, not my wife or my spouse, but I need the ambulance. And so that's what we're looking for in a 911 call, the plea for help. And in Darlie's case, she starts out saying, somebody came in here, they broke in, they just stabbed me and my children. Well, she doesn't ask specifically for help. And yes, there's an inherency when you call 911, you expect them to provide you with some assistance. But again, most people will ask, send an ambulance, send the police, wherever the case might be. She doesn't ask for that. She just tells, first thing she tells the operator is what happened. Somebody came in, they broke in. And then notice the order. They just stabbed me and my children. She talks about herself first versus her children. Now, her children are dying or already dead, some of them. We expect her, most mothers are going to ask for help. My children have been stabbed, send an ambulance. Even though they've been stabbed themselves, they may not mention that or they'll mention that second. But she puts herself first, her children second. But it's a very weak plea for help.
So the order that somebody asks for things, is that the order in which things are important to them?
Absolutely. Yeah. And order is important. We can learn a lot from order. Sometimes we can detect deception. Sometimes we can gain more information by the order a person mentions things.
And so she mentions herself first. So that means her concern lies with herself.
Correct. And I believe, I'm not exactly sure the extent of her injuries, but obviously they weren't as severe as her children because she survived and her children did not. Her children are the ones that need the ambulance more than she does. But again, she mentions herself first, her children second.
Now, her injuries were pretty severe. She nearly nicked her carotid artery, but it required surgery, but there's almost varying explanations as to how serious they were. They weren't life-threatening. It would seem that the concern would be probably for most people in a situation such as that would be for your children, who the injuries are clearly, they go on to be fatal. They're very grave injuries. But yet, like you said, she mentions herself first.
Absolutely. And again, she never specifically requests assistance.
Yeah, that's weird. I never even noticed that. But now that you pointed that out, I'm never not going to notice that with a 911 call. It's like somebody's just trying to establish this is what happened or an alibi, rather than say, I need an ambulance. I need help for my boys. These sorts of things where, yeah, you hear people calling for help and that's the very first thing. But you're right. She doesn't do that here. And it's sort of strange.
And that is what we see in true callers. That's what they'll ask for, assistance for the victim.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what about pronouns?
Well, pronouns are important. We can learn a lot by looking at the pronouns. And what we see in her 911 call is she has some changing pronouns. Again, she started out by saying somebody came in here. So somebody is a singular pronoun. But then she goes on to say they just stabbed me and my children. So she went from a singular person, one person, to the plural pronoun they. Now, in today's society, we have what's known as the singular they. If we don't know the sex of the person, sometimes people use the plural pronoun they. But in this case, she knows it's a man. In fact, later on, she'll say some man came in. And later on in her testimony and stuff, she'll say it was one person. But yet, she has a tendency to sometimes say it's one person, sometimes use the plural pronoun they. And the they is way out of line because, again, she knows the sex of the person. So it's an indication that her story's not coming from memory. I mean, if her memory, as she recalls what happened, is a man attacking her or walking away from her, that's what she'll always talk about, him, that man, he. And she would never use a plural pronoun, they. So it's, changing pronouns indicates deception. And again, in this case, she went from a singular person to plural pronoun, they.
It seems strange. Back when this case happened, there wasn't the non-binary use of the pronoun they that there is now. And they, in my totally untrained, you know, mind. I always think of they, if it's not in that context, maybe you don't know the gender, but I also think that they came in could mean multiple people. Whereas someone lacks specificity, they lacks gender. And then later she says it's a man, but it seems so vague and non-specific to be like someone or they. You later describe that it's a man and give it is kind of a description that lacks specificity and that it's like a 6 foot tall man or whatever. And he's wearing a baseball hat. So it just seems strange that she isn't like a man broke in and he did this. It's almost like distancing herself from like this person being a real thing.
Yeah. And again, if it's coming from memory, as she recalls what happened, she'll consistently use the singular pronoun, the male pronoun. But by using the pronoun they, it's an indication it's not coming from memory. Perhaps she's making up this portion of her call or her statement. And so she unknowingly switches pronouns.
So we can learn a lot by a statement if somebody is indeed switching pronouns versus keeping consistent with pronouns.
Yeah, they should always be consistent with the pronouns. Absolutely.
So during the call, Darlie says, they stabbed me and my kids, stabbed my boys. She later says, my little boy is dying. And then she goes on to say, my babies are dying. Also, she refers to Damon and Devin as babies, kids, children, and boys throughout the call. Is this significant?
It is significant because everybody has their own what I call personal dictionary. Certain words mean certain things to people. For example, some people may view a firearm as a gun and somebody else may call it a pistol. Again, everybody has their own personal dictionary. Now, in statement analysis, there are no synonyms. Every word means something different. I mean, gun and pistol may refer to the same firearm, but it doesn't mean the exact same thing. And so a change in language is an indication of deception unless we see a justification for that change. In other words, I've seen statements from police officers. I drew my gun. I fired my weapon. I holstered my gun. So we had a change in language. We went from gun to weapon. Indicates possible deception unless there's a justification for the change. In this case, there probably is. To that officer, the word gun means it's in my hand, it's in my holster, but the word weapon means I'm discharging. And once the shooting stops, I go back to calling it a gun again. Now, to another officer, I drew my gun, I fired my pistol. Perhaps that's their personal dictionary. You'll see it a lot with how people reference their automobile. Most people refer to their automobile as a car. They won't call it a vehicle. Car is a little bit more personal. But when they get into an accident, or the car breaks down, then sometimes they'll start referring to it as a vehicle. So to that person, the word car means it's operable, vehicle means it's disabled or it's damaged. And so what we see here, as you pointed out, is that she used several nouns to describe her children. She called them children, kids, little boys. And so we see a change in language. If she viewed them as her little boys, she would always refer to them as her little boys, unless there's a reason why the language changed, a justifiable reason. As I look at it, I don't see a reason why the language should change. So it's an indication she's not following her personal dictionary. She is telling a truthful story, and she viewed them as kids. She'd always call them kids. Now, perhaps once they've been injured, maybe then she refers them to something different. But again, I think we have her using four different nouns to refer to her children, and that's just too many changes in language, which again indicates the story's not coming from memory. She's making it up. She's not sticking to her personal dictionary.
So can a mental health diagnosis, like we know Darlie was suffering from postpartum depression, some have suggested psychosis, postpartum psychosis. Could this impact the way in which somebody speaks or uses, you know, nouns or pronouns? Or in your opinion, if they're shifting like this, does it always indicate deception?
Well, if somebody has some mental disabilities, then yes, that can influence how they phrase their statement or what pronouns they may use or possibly change in language. And so that's why we're not looking for just one thing. Hey, this person's lying based on this one factor, but we're looking for several indications of deception. And she will show a lot of different indications of deception. And so just being depressed doesn't really explain all of those.
Fair enough. Okay, let's talk about Darlie's use of the word even.
Yeah, she said twice. She said, I don't even know. And it was unintelligible. Both times it was unintelligible. So we're not sure what she was going to say she didn't know about. But the point is you don't need the word even. In statement analysis, the shortest sentence is the best sentence. I don't know such and such. That's a good statement. But she said, I don't even know. So why'd she use the word even? Well, the word even indicates a contrast of ideas. So it indicates she's making a comparison. She's thinking about something else. And again, we don't know what she was talking about because it was hard to hear. But it's possible she was thinking, well, I do know versus I'm going to lie and say I don't know. Again, we don't know if that's the case. But what we know for a fact is she don't need to use the word even, because it always indicates she's thinking about something else. And so in an interview setting, I would want to ask her, you know, what else was she thinking about? What else was going on during that time period?
So would there ever be an appropriate time for someone to say, I don't even know? It sort of feels stilted. I mean, I don't even know feels strange as I practice saying it myself.
Well, yeah, it's because the word's not needed. Pretty much every time you see the word even, you can remove from the sentence and the sentence is still grammatically correct. And so, yeah, there are times it's appropriate to use because it's still going to indicate some type of comparison, but maybe we can see the comparison. You know, for example, if a person asks somebody, have you seen Bob lately? The person might reply, no, I don't even know if he's still in town. Well, again, they use the word even. It could have just said, I don't know if he's in town, but by saying if he's even in town, they're probably comparing, I haven't seen him with, maybe he left town. That's probably what the comparison is there. So there are times when it's appropriate to use if we can see what the comparison is.
Yeah, that makes sense. So where does Darlie's concern seem to lie during this 911 call?
Well, at one point, she makes the comment to the operator, we got to find out who it was. And I view that as a very unusual statement, because especially in a 911 call, people usually won't talk about who did this, who committed the crime. They're just concerned, especially when your children have been injured and need medical assistance. That's what your focus is on. So for her to just at some point say, we got to find out who it was very odd. I mean, again, she sounds like she's trying to point towards there was an intruder that, you know, came into the house, that theory. She's trying to make it sound like, hey, I'm a concerned parent. I need to find out who harmed my kids. But again, a real parent is going to focus on the children. Now, later on, after they've had get to the hospital, get treatment, then, yes, we start to focus on, well, now who did this? We need to find this person. But not during a 911 call.
So this is basically, so what you're saying is this is atypical in 911 calls by parents requesting help for their children.
Correct. Yeah. Most parents aren't going to ask about, you know, we got to catch this person. Now, again, if somebody witnessed something, somebody got in a car, drove off, yeah, they may tell the operator that, you know, what the description of the person, the car, you know, we need to catch that person. But again, the primary focus is on the victim. The victim needs help. And so it's a very unusual statement for her to make that.
So is the fact that Darlie isn't saying he threw the knife down or he did these things with regards to the alleged perpetrator indicating deception, in your opinion?
Well, yeah, what she said was, I woke up, I was fighting. He ran out through the garage, threw the knife down. Now, remember, we believe what people tell us. So she says, I woke up. Okay, I believe you woke up. I was fighting. I believe you were fighting. But who are you fighting? She doesn't say I was fighting him or I was fighting the man, you know, that was in my house. She just simply says I was fighting. He ran out through the garage. Okay, I believe he ran out through the garage. But then she says, threw the knife down. Well, who threw the knife down? Again, there are no understood subjects in statement analysis. People have to tell us what's going on. So if she would have said he threw the knife down, then I can believe that. Or if she used the word and. You know, he ran out through the garage and threw the knife down. The word and connects both thoughts together. But that's not what she did. She just gave two different statements. He ran out through the garage, then she kind of hesitated, paused, and then said, threw the knife down. Well, it's easier to say threw the knife down if that's not what happened versus he threw the knife down. That's getting more specific, and it's hard for her to say that. So she left the pronoun he out and just simply said, threw the knife down. But again, we can't believe that happened unless she tells us that it happened.
So Darlie says during the 911 call, quote, God, I bet if we could have gotten the prints, maybe, with regards to the knife. The fact that she's even considering forensics at this time bothers so many people. Does this bother you as well?
It does. Again, because the focus now is not on help for my children. She's shifting to, again, trying to catch this person. But also, you know, she's talking about fingerprints. She talks about how she picked up the knife. And so now she's explaining why her fingerprints are going to be on the knife, why perhaps you won't find the killer's fingerprints because maybe she, you know, smudged them or something. But it's very unusual for any 911 caller to focus on, you know, let's catch this person when the immediate thought is I need help for my children.
So at one point, Darlie says the boys are dead and later says they're dying. She switches back and forth often. Later, she says, quote, they're dying. Oh, my God, they're dead, end quote. She says this multiple times throughout, and we know one of the boys is alive when first responders get there. So this isn't accurate. Is this important?
It is important because, again, if her memory was one child appears to be deceased, but another one is still alive and still breathing, then that's what they're going to tell us. And that's what her concern would be. At least one child is still alive. I need help. We need to get an ambulance here. I want to save his life. But for her to go back and forth, and it's possible because one was, maybe she viewed one as being dead, the other one was still alive. Maybe that's why she's jumping around. But most people are going to just, you know, realize a child is still alive. That's what they're going to talk about. That's more reason to get an ambulance there as quick as possible. That's more of an urgency to tell the operator, you got to get somebody here because, you know, my youngest one, my oldest one, whatever, you know, is still alive.
Yeah, that totally makes sense because it's one of those things that sort of bothers, it definitely bothers a lot of people who look at this case, right? It's just unsettling. So all of these details that you're piling on top of one another, the more I listen to you speak, the more I'm slightly moving off the fence and soft leaning in the direction of deception. Darlie then says, I feel really bad. I think I'm dying. Is this statement significant to you?
It is somewhat significant because, again, the focus is on herself and not her children. She's letting us know that she was injured as well and making it sound like it's a very severe injury. You know, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. Obviously, her kids' injuries were severe, but she's trying to make it sound like, you know, she's dying. Another reason to get help there. She doesn't ask for help to get there in a hurry, but simply alluding to it. And so it is important. Again, it's kind of unusual for a victim in a 911 call to make a statement like that.
In regards to the length of time she's waiting, Darlie says, quote, I got to just sit here forever. Oh, my God. Did anything stand out about this choice of words?
Well, again, what she's alluding to is she wants the medical emergency services to get there very quick. And so, but why allude to it? I mean, most 911 calls, when I hear them, people will say, hurry, they got to get here. Where are they? And the operator's telling them they're on their way. They'll be there. But she doesn't ask for that. She just kind of alludes to it by saying, as you point out, yeah, I just got to sit here forever. Again, notice who she's talking about. I just got to sit here forever. Not her children. Hurry up. They're dying. Get here. But just, you know, I got to sit here for me. And then she says, oh, my God. And what I tell people is anytime somebody invokes the name of God, that light bulb in your head should turn on. Now, usually we're talking about statements like, I swear to God or honest to God, trying to make it sound like I'm being truthful. But anytime they just mention God, yeah, it's a slight indication that perhaps, you know, they are being deceptive there, trying to bolster their statement, you know, by using the word God there. But yeah, her focus is on herself and she doesn't specifically ask for help, just kind of alludes to it. I got to sit here forever.
So during like a casual conversation, can it be more of a turn of phrase? Because I'll certainly say during a casual conversation, talking to somebody, oh my God, I swear to God, you know what I mean? And I'm not being deceptive. It's just meant for emphasis, but never during like somebody is accusing me of something and it's like, I'm innocent. I swear to God. So can it be like a normal turn of phrase during a casual conversation?
It can be. And what I tell people is that when you hear phrases such as I swear to God or honest to God, in the case of deception, about 50% of the time, because as you pointed out, people sometimes have a habit of using that phrase or phrases like that. It depends on which phrase we're talking about. And again, the context in which they're being used. So that's why I tell people it's an indication, but probably 50% of the time indicates deception.
So I'll usually say it if it's something funny and someone's like, that didn't happen. It's like, no, I swear to God that happened. Not like I swear to God I'm innocent. But yeah, I can see how it can become like in my vocabulary, it's sort of a habituated phrase. It's not ever meant to like be calling on God. But I mean, I've never been accused of anything serious. So I don't think I would invoke God.
Well, and I tell people if somebody doesn't, especially for law enforcement, if you're interviewing somebody and they sense you don't believe them and yet they're being truthful, that may cause them to say, you know, I swear to God or honest to God, you know? So yeah, sometimes based on how we ask questions, we bring it on ourselves. We force a person to say something like that because they are being truthful and they realize we don't believe them. So then I feel like they got to say something else to emphasize
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So Darley later says, quote, "They killed our babies," but describes the intruder as a 6-foot white male. She never says multiple intruders. We spoke about this a little bit earlier, but this just really bothers me. They killed our babies when we know it's only supposed to be one man. Is this one of those things when you looked at it and you were like, aha?
It was an aha moment. I mean, it's a big red flag, again, the changing pronouns. In her mind, if she's given a truthful statement and she can see this one man in her house responsible for killing her kids, that's what she will always talk about, him, that man, he, and will not use the plural pronoun they. Because she knows it's one person, she knows it's a man, it's a male, so therefore the they is completely out of place.
So now we're going to go through Darley's written statement. So Mark, what were your overall impressions of the statement after reading through it?
Again, she showed signs of deception, not as many as the 911 call, but it wasn't a very long written statement. But she did show some indications of deception. Again, she had to change the language. She talked about the boys, the children, the babies. Again, using 3 different nouns to describe her kids. And I don't see a justification for that change. So again, if we don't see a justification, then we lean towards deception. And again, we're not, you know, just because somebody had to change the language doesn't mean, hey, you're lying to me. It's an indication of it, but we're looking for several indications. And she did have some other indications of deception in her written statement.
So is there any difference with regard to accuracy of detecting deception between the written word, such as this statement by Darley, and her spoken words in the 911 call?
Well, most of the time, written statements, we get more accurate information. And that's because, one, it's preserved in writing. So we can take our time analyzing it. Even after you read it one time, you may read it a second time and something else will jump out at you. When you're analyzing a verbal statement, an oral statement, well, then you have to be quicker on your feet. And they may say something and it slips past you, or as you're trying to take notes, you fail to hear something. And so that's why written statements usually will produce more information, truthful or deceptive. Also, people have a tendency to tell us more in a written statement versus a verbal statement. So sometimes we gain more information, whether they're being truthful or deceptive, when it comes to a written statement.
What else did you see in her written statement?
Well, she talked about it sounded like they're having problems in their marriage. She doesn't say specifically in this written statement what they were, but she said we talked about a few problems. Then she said they had a few words between them. Well, had a few words, that indicates they were having an argument of some sort. And then she does also says in her written statement that she was depressed. And I think she recently had a child, and so she may have been suffering from postpartum depression. And so we ask ourselves, does that have anything to do with what happened that night? You know, did she kill her kids because she was depressed? Did she kill them because she was resentful, having an argument with her husband? You know, does any of that tie in? It's something we definitely want to take a look at to see if that was a motive for her killing her own children.
So what else did you see when you looked at this?
Well, in her written statement, she wrote, "After a while, I started to get sleepy." So again, we believe what people tell us. What she wants us to believe is she went to sleep, but she doesn't say that. She just says, "I started to get sleepy." So I believe you started to get sleepy, but you haven't told me that I fell asleep or I went to sleep. Now, if you look at her husband's statement, Darren, he says that. He said, "I fell asleep and then woke up when he heard his wife screaming." So she never tells us she specifically went to sleep. And so we can't believe she did that. So is it possible she never did go to sleep, but then at some point, you know, killed her kids and then yelled for help for her husband?
So a statement that would be less likely to be deceptive would be, "I was sleepy and must have drifted off, and I woke up and felt pressure on me." Am I kind of on the right track here?
On the right track. Not to use the word must, but I did fall asleep would be a better statement, more definitive statement. And then I woke up and, you know, like you said, felt pressure on my neck. But what she says is, the next thing, I wake up and feel pressure on me. Now, again, she says the next thing. That indicates she's skipping over something. Now, again, she wants us to believe she was sleeping, which is fine, but it'd be better to say, "I woke up and felt this pressure." But she just says the next thing, so she skipped over something. And then she uses present tense language. "I wake up and feel pressure on me." Again, if a person's telling us what happened to them, doesn't matter if it was 5 minutes ago or 5 years ago, it's all in the past tense. So as they relive that moment in their mind, describing what happened, they'll use past tense verbs. What she should have said was, "I woke up and felt pressure on me." And so it's a strong indication that that portion of her statement is not coming from memory.
So that would be something that she would be kind of constructing in that moment, hence the present tense language.
Correct, because they're presently constructing it. They unknowingly use present tense verbs.
So is the switching between tenses typically something you look for when analyzing a statement?
We do, because we expect any statement talking about something happened in the past to be in the past tense. And some people, even though they're making up a story, they'll think about, well, how, if this happened to me, how would I describe it? And they'll use past tense verbs. They'll get it right. But a lot of people, if they're making up a story, or at least a portion of their story, there may be present tense language in that one area. They may start out, tell us what happened that day. It's all in the past tense. But when they get to the incident itself, because they're making it up, they may use some present tense verbs. And then after the incident is over with, as they talk about what happened later on, they go back to using the past tense again. But we focus on that present tense language. In an interview setting, we'd ask a few more questions to see what was going on or what was not going on.
So, like, for example, if parents were in front of the media making a plea for their child to come back, but they're speaking about their child in the past tense, like he was this rather than he is the light of our life, he was the light of our life, would that be indicative of deception or at least cause for concern?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, when it comes to missing person cases, it's just the opposite. We're looking for past tense language. And when a parent or guardian talks about that missing person in the past tense, they're telling us they know something we don't know. They know that missing person is dead. And we've seen it over and over with Scott Peterson and his wife and Susan Smith and her, who drowned her kids, all referred to them in the past tense prior to, you know, their bodies being discovered or their confession.
Which would typically indicate that they're privy to some kind of knowledge that the public doesn't have.
Right. They know the person's dead, so it makes absolutely sense to talk about them in the past tense. But not when you're trying to cover up that lie. You should talk about them in the present tense.
So to circle back to what you say is to listen to what they're saying, because they're always telling you the truth. So it would be truthful that that individual is dead and that person is telling you that with that statement by using the past tense.
Yeah, believe what people tell you. Oh, she was a great wife. I believe she was, but she no longer is. So why is that? Yeah.
That's so interesting. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Darlie's testimony. What was your overall impression of this?
Again, she showed some signs of deception in her testimony. Most of it was during direct examination, you know, by her attorney. Again, she had the change in language, unjustified change in language. We saw it in a 911 call. We saw it in a written statement, and we saw it in her testimony. She said there was a man, and later she said, I could see the guy. Well, man and guy may refer to the same person, the intruder. They don't mean the exact same thing. There's a reason why that language changed. If she viewed him as a man, she would always call him a man. So the question is, why did the language change? And it's either because he's making up the story, he didn't exist, or there's a justifiable reason for the change. Now, most of the time, we can kind of see if it's justifiable reason, what the reason is. But as I look at her statement, I don't see one. So again, we lean towards deception. She's not following her own personal dictionary.
So we're seeing like someone, they, man, guy, and then we're seeing boys, kids, babies, like those children. We're seeing all of these different pronouns used to describe people. And this would not be typical in the language of an individual if they were being truthful, correct?
Correct. Yeah. A truthful person will be consistent in their language. If they view their children as kids, they'll always call them kids. Or if they view the intruder as being a guy, they'll always refer to him as a guy. Again, unless there's a reason why the language would change, and I don't see a justifiable reason.
I keep re-emphasizing this point because for most of the listeners, they're unfamiliar with statement analysis. So I'm hoping that along the way, they can learn with me as we go and hopefully kind of take some of these points from this interview and be able to apply it to their own lives. Hopefully not in the context of crime. So what does she say next that bothers you in this statement?
Well, later on, she'll say, I started to get up. I started to walk towards the kitchen. Now, the word started means there was a break in the action. And she doesn't tell us what she was doing during that break. Either you got up or you didn't get up. But by saying I started to get up, well, what does that mean? Or I started to walk towards the kitchen, but something caused her to stop. And she doesn't explain. She acts like she you know, got up and walked into the kitchen. And so, again, in an interview setting, I'm going to ask some questions about that, have her repeat that portion of her statement, and, you know, see what else is going on there. What have you told me that you were doing? But the word started always means there was a break in the action.
So started is like next, right? It indicates that something's being skipped.
Yeah, correct. Something's being skipped over.
Okay, so let's talk about the knife again for a second.
All right. Well, a couple of things with the knife. One is she said she saw the knife laying on and then she stopped. And then later she said, I saw the knife lying over there, I think is what she said. But the point is that she's given life to an inanimate object. You know, knives are not capable of lying or laying down. And so when people do that, it's an indication of deception. The theory is that because the person put the knife on the ground, they caused the action, they caused the knife to have life, therefore they use the word laying or lying. Now, I did a study on this, and I found that it's true about 50% of the time. Again, 50% of the time, truthful people would give life to an inanimate object. For example, if a person asks somebody, hey, where's the remote for the TV? The person might respond, it's laying on the end table. Again, technically, knives are not capable of laying, but it's just something that's come into our vernacular over the years. And so, again, it's an indication of deception. We take a look at it, ask a few more questions. But again, it's only about 50% of the time. Now, I've seen statements where a person said the garage door was standing open. Well, again, doors are not capable of standing. But again, some people have a habit of using that. And again, some people use it because they're being deceptive. And so it's just something to look at when a person gives life to an inanimate object. And she did that with the knife. Now, the other thing she said about the knife is that three times she said it was an instinct to pick it up. And again, that telling us that three times is just overuse. She's trying to convince us the only reason she picked up the knife is because it was just an instinct to do it. Again, she's explaining why her fingerprints are on the knife. She's explaining why maybe you won't find somebody else's prints because, you know, mine are on top of theirs, perhaps. To say it one time would even be somewhat suspicious, but to say it three times, that's definitely, you know, catches our attention there.
It's a weird statement to begin with, to say it was my instinct to pick up the knife, maybe my instinct to help my child, but not my instinct to pick up the knife. It just sounds bizarre.
It is. And that's, and she says that, I think she, in a 911 call, she talks about picking up the knife. Well, the operator tells her, don't touch it. I think she said she already picked it up. But yeah, again, she's just trying to give a reason why you'll find her prints on there and maybe not somebody else's prints. There was one other thing she talked about the knife. After she said she picked it up, she said, I picked up the knife, I brought it back to the kitchen counter. Again, recognize what she's saying. I brought it back to the kitchen counter. And the word back would indicate that she picked it up off the kitchen counter, did something with it, and now she's replacing it. She's putting it back. Now, it's possible that if that knife has a spot on the kitchen counter and she sees it's lying on the floor and knows that's not where it's supposed to be, then she picks it up and puts it back. But most people would say, I picked it up and placed it on the kitchen counter. But the word back is a strong indication that she removed the knife from the kitchen counter and then later returned it, because that's what the word, you know, back would indicate.
So words like back and next and started to indicate maybe lapses in time, but also lapses in action. Like it indicates that from what you're saying, that there's this space and time that she's not telling us what happened, right? Like if it was, she's putting it back, if it was already there, what was it doing on there? And did you take it from there? Or did that other individual, they, someone, or this perpetrator, intruder, however she's describing him, did he take it from there? And then you're just saying it was on there, he used it and then put it back there. But that just seems to be quite strange language to choose.
It is. It's a stronger indication that she took the knife, removed it from the kitchen counter, and then did exactly what she told us, put it back, you know, returned it, versus somebody else removing that knife. Because again, and we'd have to look at the crime scene and you know, and these are questions we would ask, exactly where does that knife go? Some people have a block with, you know, knives stuck in them. She doesn't say she returned it to something like that. She just simply said kitchen counter. And so, again, I think most people would say, I placed it on the kitchen counter. But she says, I put it back. And so I believe what you're telling me, that you probably removed it. And now you returned it, put it back.
So did you see anything else in her testimony?
The one other thing I saw was under cross-examination by the assistant district attorney. And he asked her a question. So you don't think that you would have woken up if a man started stabbing you? And she answered, I have no idea of what happened that night. Now, very rarely can a person honestly say, I have no idea or no clue. I mean, most people have an idea and opinion on just about everything. You know, I have an idea how we can send astronauts to Mars. It probably won't work. I'm not a rocket scientist, but, you know, I got an opinion. I got an idea. So when you hear that phrase, I have no idea, no clue, very hard to believe that. Now, some people will say that because they don't want to offer a suggestion or an opinion. You know, maybe a friend will say, well, I have no idea. But the truth is they do have an idea. But when you deal with a suspect who says, I have no idea, that's a stronger indication of suspicion. Because very rarely can a person honestly say that. And, you know, she said, I have no idea what happened that night. Well, of course she has an idea. She saw a man walking away from her. Her kids were stabbed. She believes this man came in and stabbed her kids. That's what she has an idea. But now she's kind of backing away from that by saying, I have no idea what happened that night. And so that caught my attention as well. She said it one other time as well, used that phrase, I have no idea, under cross-examination. And there are some cases where a person can honestly say, I have no idea. And that might be one of them, you know, why somebody would do this. You know, if it truly was an intruder, that might be correct. But yeah, to say I have no idea of what happened that night is a stronger indication of deception.
So if we are to believe it was an intruder and Darlie said, I have no idea why it happened, that might make sense because she wasn't raped and there was no jewelry taken. So the motive remains unclear. But again, she didn't say why. She says, I have no idea what happened. And like you said, I think we've got a pretty clear picture from what she said, that she's saying she knows what happened, that somebody came in, cut her throat, stabbed her boys, and left basically with nothing. But yet she's saying, I have no idea what happened. So yeah, these two things are kind of incongruous.
Yep, that's correct. But the big red flag, what catches your first attention first is that phrase, I have no idea, because rarely can a person honestly say that.
So Mark, you've looked at plenty of Darlie's statements, from her testimony to her 911 call, to her statements to law enforcement. Do you think you have a clear picture as to her guilt or innocence?
It's pretty clear to me after analyzing all three of those that she is guilty, that there was no intruder. She's very consistent in her language, man, guy, they versus he, that there was no intruder, but that she most likely, you know, killed her kids, maybe because she was depressed, having problems in her marriage.
So do you have any final thoughts on the case of Darlie Routier?
I don't know what the evidence was. I know she went to trial and was found guilty, so I think the jury, you know, got it right.
Yeah, I mean, there's some questions with the jury. I mean, there's so many things to point out with this case that were flawed. Like the two lead detectives ended up pleading the fifth because they basically held back this prayer vigil video, but they showed the silly string video, and jurors have come forward and said they didn't say it was prejudicial, but it was obviously prejudicial because they've said, had we seen this prayer vigil that was held before the silly string video, then perhaps we would have thought differently of her. Like they watched this video 9 times, I think. And they convicted her within 8 hours. And also we had one of the jurors, I can't remember, her name is Carrie Parrish or something. And she spoke about Darlie's augmented breasts and her fake, you know, blonde hair and basically the ostentatious displays of wealth, and judged her very much. Like, I would never do that, were phrases that were used in a documentary. Like, I would never get my breasts done. I would never do this. And it's sort of like, it was held in Kentsville, Texas. So a small town, it wasn't necessarily her peers. And I'm not saying she didn't do it, but I think there was some egregious errors, including like, it was like 20,000 errors by a court transcriber who again pled the fifth when asked why. There's like 3 people with regards to this case pleading the fifth, and it's strange. So I don't know. I don't know what happened, but I don't necessarily know if she got a fair trial. And also, like you mentioned it earlier, Diane Downs being in the public consciousness, people considering that this mother who kills her children is a thing, whether right or wrong, I think it definitely influenced the media coverage.
Yeah. Yeah. She may not have got a fair trial, but you know, based on what I saw, again, I never looked at the evidence, but based on what I saw in her statements, you know, I believe, you know, she did it. She's being deceptive. And I think even in a fair trial, I think the outcome would have been the same.
That's super interesting. I really loved hearing your opinions on this. And I know everyone's going to find this super, super enlightening because I've never had an expert in statement analysis come on. And I know everyone's really fascinated by it. When I'm emailing Mark, I'm like, what is he thinking about what I'm writing? Is he analyzing my statements?
In my classes, I always give people the warning, do not use these techniques on family and friends. or you might not have any more family and friends. So There I say, save it for the true crime shows that you're watching.
So, Mark, do you want to tell my listeners a little bit about each of your books, the training you provide, and what you're working on now?
Yeah, the first book I wrote was in 2001. It's called I Know You're Lying, Detecting Deception Through Statement Analysis. And half the book is dedicated to the statement analysis techniques. Half the book is dedicated to analyze some high-profile cases. Who's being truthful? Who's being deceptive in the O.J. Simpson murder trial, JonBenet Ramsey case, Dr. Martin Luther King assassination, and five other high-profile cases. In 2012, my second book came out. It's called Don't Be Deceived. And discusses the only three ways you can tell somebody's lying without the aid of a machine. And that is through statement analysis, body language, and handwriting analysis. Now, handwriting analysis is better suited towards personality traits. So based on this guy's handwriting, you don't want him dating your daughter. He just shows signs of being a violent person. But there's some indications in a person's handwriting that indicate they're secretive and they're maybe withholding information. Just one chapter on handwriting because it's better suited towards personality traits. Three chapters on body language, some of the more common things we see when a person's being deceptive. And when the hand comes up and touches the chin or touches the lips, it's an indication perhaps what the person just said is not being completely truthful, something to look for. But the majority of the book, some 16 chapters, is on statement analysis and some additional techniques that are not discussed in the first book. They're available through my website, which is statementanalysis.com, as well as amazon.com. Now, I do have some online training. Statement analysis on demand training. You can sign in at any time, take it at your own pace. I give people, I think it's 120 days to complete the training. There are some statements to analyze, compare your analysis with a completed one. There are some quizzes to take. I mean, it's basically an open book, you know, test. Everybody's going to pass. But the final statement, I have them analyze it, send it to me, and I give them some feedback on how well they're doing, you know, with the techniques. It's a good way to take the training. Again, it's at your own pace. It's a self-guided course. It's only available through my website, you know, statementanalysis.com. You can also check out where I'll be speaking this year. In a couple of days, I'll be going to Texas, conducting, speaking at CrimeCon, and then I'll be doing four classes throughout the state of Texas. But you can check my schedule, see if I'm going to be anywhere near you. If not, then maybe consider taking the on-demand training.
Do you all hear that? He's going to be at CrimeCon. So definitely check Mark out there if you're going to be. Where is it held this year? I forgot.
It's in Austin, Texas. I'm speaking Saturday at 4:30.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really, really appreciate it. I know my listeners are going to enjoy it as much as I have. So if people want to reach out to you on social media, where can they reach out? Do you have any social media accounts?
The best place to get a hold of me is through my website. My email address is AIC@statementanalysis.com, but you know, there's a link on my website, contact information. Send me an email if you have any questions. I'm more than happy to answer them.
Well, thank you for joining me and sharing your expertise in statement analysis, Mark. It's been really eye-opening for me, and I'm sure everyone else is going to really enjoy it.
Well, Jules, thank you for having me on your show.
You are so welcome. Thank you for listening. That concludes our episode on the statement analysis of Darlie Routier's words. I really want to thank Mark McClish for coming on and helping me learn a few things, and hopefully he helped you learn a few things as well. There's going to be plenty more episodes to come, so buckle up. And I just want to let all of you know who aren't aware that Dr. Ashley Wellman and I have a Patreon. We've got a few episodes out there right now. At the $5 level, you get a Jules and Ashley episode. At the $10 level, you also get a Path Went Chilly mini. So definitely check that out, and I will link that in the show notes. I also want to thank our new Patreons, Ashley from TSFU the Podcast. I love you, Ashley. Megan Cotter, Jen, and Amelia Elaine. Thank you so much for your support. We really appreciate it. So if you really want to help out the show, if you love what we're doing, please don't forget to rate and review. It really, really goes a long way. So until next time, stay safe, and remember, accept nothing, question everything.
Loophole!
Bye.
have had what some would call an unhealthy obsession with the horrors of the world for well over 30 years now, real and fictional. So if any of that piques your interest, you can find me on your podcast platform of choice. And of course, don't forget to rate and review and subscribe. I'd really appreciate it. Thanks for listening. Bye.